as the 17th century dawned, scarcely 100 years after Columbus's momentous landfall. The face of much of the New World had already been profoundly transformed. European crops and livestock had begun to alter the very landscape, touching off an ecological revolution that would reverberate for centuries to come. From Tierra del Fuego in the south to Hudson Bay in the north, disease and armed conquest had cruelly winnowed and disrupted the native peoples. Several hundred thousand enslaved Africans toiled on Caribbean and Brazilian sugar plantations. From Florida and New Mexico southward, most of the New World lay firmly within the grip of Imperial Spain. But north of Mexico, America in 1600 remained largely unexplored and effectively unclaimed by Europeans. Then, as if to herald the coming century of colonization and conflict in the northern continent, three European powers planted three primitive outposts in three distant corners of the continent within 3 years of one another. The Spanish at Santa Fe in 1610, the French at Quebec in 1608, and, most consequentially for the future United States, the English at Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. Feeble indeed were England's efforts in the 1500s to compete with the sprawling Spanish Empire. As Spain's ally in the first half of the century, England took little interest in establishing its own overseas colonies. Religious conflict also disrupted England in mid-century. After King Henry VIII broke with the Roman Catholic Church in the 1530s, launching the English Protestant Reformation. Catholics battled Protestants for decades, and the religious balance of power seesawed. But after the Protestant Elizabeth ascended to the English throne in 1558, Protestantism became dominant in England, and rivalry with Catholic Spain intensified. Ireland, which nominally had been under English rule since the 12th century, became an early scene of that rivalry. The Catholic Irish sought help from Catholic Spain to throw off the yoke of the new Protestant English queen. But Spanish aid never amounted to much. In the 1570s and 1580s, Elizabeth's troops crushed the Irish uprising with terrible ferocity, inflicting unspeakable atrocities upon the native Irish people. The English crown confiscated Catholic Irish lands and planted them with new Protestant landlords from Scotland and England. This policy also planted the seeds of the centuries-old religious conflicts that persist in Ireland to the present day. Many English soldiers developed in Ireland a sneering contempt for the savage natives, an attitude that they brought with them to the New World. Encouraged by the ambitious Elizabeth I, hardy English buccaneers now swarmed out upon the shipping lanes. They sought to promote the twin goals of Protestantism and plunder by seizing Spanish treasure ships and raiding Spanish settlements, even though England and Spain were technically at peace. The most famous of these semi-piratical sea dogs was the courtly Sir Francis Drake. He swashbuckled and looted his way around the planet, returning in 1580 with his ship heavily ballasted with Spanish booty. The venture netted profits of about 4,600% to his financial backers, among whom, in secret, was Queen Elizabeth. Defying Spanish protest, she brazenly knighted Drake on the deck of his barnacled ship. The bleak coast of Newfoundland was the scene of the first English attempt at colonization. This effort collapsed when its promoter, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, lost his life at sea in 1583. Gilbert's ill-starred dream inspired his gallant half-brother, Sir Walter Raleigh, to try again in warmer climes. Raleigh organized an expedition that first landed in 1585 on North Carolina's Roanoke Island, off the coast of Virginia, a vaguely defined region named in honor of Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen. After several false starts, the hapless Roanoke colony mysteriously vanished, swallowed up by the wilderness. These pathetic English failures at colonization contrasted embarrassingly with the glories of the Spanish Empire, whose profits were fabulously enriching Spain. Philip II of Spain, self-anointed foe of the Protestant Reformation, used part of his imperial gains to amass an invincible armada of ships for an invasion of England. The showdown came in 1588 when the lumbering Spanish flotilla, 130 strong, hove into the English Channel. The English sea dogs fought back, using craft that were swifter, more maneuverable, and more ably manned. They inflicted heavy damage on the cumbersome, overladen Spanish ships. Then a devastating storm arose, the Protestant wind, scattering the crippled Spanish fleet. The rout of the Spanish Armada marked the beginning of the end of Spanish imperial dreams, though Spain's New World Empire would not fully collapse for three more centuries. Within a few decades, the Spanish Netherlands, Holland, would secure its independence, and much of the Spanish Caribbean would slip from Spain's grasp. Bloated by Peruvian and Mexican silver and cockily convinced of its own invincibility, Spain had overreached itself, sowing the seeds of its own decline. England's victory over the Spanish Armada also marked a red-letter day in American history. It dampened Spain's fighting spirit and helped ensure England's naval dominance in the North Atlantic. It started England on its way to becoming master of the world oceans, a fact of enormous importance to the American people. Indeed, England now had many of the characteristics that Spain displayed on the eve of its colonizing adventure a century earlier: a strong, unified national state under a popular monarch, a measure of religious unity after a protracted struggle between Protestants and Catholics, and a vibrant sense of nationalism and national destiny. A wondrous flowering of the English national spirit bloomed in the wake of the Spanish Armada's defeat. A golden age of literature dawned in this exhilarating atmosphere, with William Shakespeare at its forefront, making occasional poetical references to England's American colonies. The English were seized with restlessness, with thirst for adventure, and with curiosity about the unknown. Everywhere there blossomed a new spirit of self-confidence, of vibrant patriotism, and of boundless faith in the future of the English nation. When England and Spain finally signed a treaty of peace in 1604, the English people were poised to plunge headlong into the planting of their own colonial empire in the New World. England's sceptered isle, as Shakespeare called it, throbbed with social and economic change as the 17th century opened. Its population was mushrooming from some 3 million people in 1550 to about 4 million in 1600. In the evergreen English countryside, landlords were enclosing croplands for sheep grazing, forcing many small farmers into precarious tenancy or off the land altogether. It was no accident that the woolen districts of eastern and western England, where Puritanism had taken strong root, supplied many of the earliest immigrants to America. When economic depression hit the woolen trade in the late 1500s, thousands of footloose farmers took to the roads. They drifted about England, chronically unemployed, often ending up as beggars and paupers in cities like Bristol and London. This remarkable mobile population alarmed many contemporaries. They concluded that England was burdened with a surplus population, though present-day London holds twice as many people as did all of England in 1600. At the same time, laws of primogeniture decreed that only eldest sons were eligible to inherit landed estates. Landholders' ambitious younger sons, among them Gilbert, Raleigh, and Drake, were forced to seek their fortunes elsewhere. Bad luck plagued their early lone wolf enterprises, but by the early 1600s, when the joint stock company, forerunner of the modern corporation, was perfected, a considerable number of investors, called adventurers, were able to pool their capital. Peace with a chastened Spain provided the opportunity for English colonization. Population growth provided the workers. Unemployment, as well as a thirst for adventure, for markets, and for religious freedom, provided the motives. Joint stock companies provided the financial means. The stage was now set for a historic effort to establish an English beachhead in the still uncharted North American wilderness. In 1606, 2 years after peace with Spain, the hand of destiny beckoned toward Virginia. A joint stock company, known as the Virginia Company of London, received a charter from King James I of England for settlement in the New World. The main attraction was the promise of gold, combined with a strong desire to find a passage through America to the Indies. Like most joint stock companies of the day, the Virginia Company was intended to endure for only a few years, after which its stockholders hoped to liquidate it for a profit. This arrangement put severe pressure on the luckless colonists, who were threatened with abandonment in the wilderness if they did not quickly strike it rich on the company's behalf. Few of the investors thought in terms of long-term colonization. Apparently, no one even faintly suspected that the seeds of a mighty nation were being planted. The Charter of the Virginia Company is a significant document in American history. It guaranteed to the overseas settlers the same rights of Englishmen that they would have enjoyed if they had stayed at home. This precious boon was gradually extended to subsequent English colonies, helping to reinforce the colonists' sense that even on the far shores of the Atlantic, they remained comfortably within the embrace of traditional English institutions. But ironically, a century and a half later, their insistence on the rights of Englishmen fed hot resentment against an increasingly meddlesome mother country and nourished their appetite for independence. Setting sail in late 1606, the Virginia Company's three ships landed near the mouth of Chesapeake Bay, where Indians attacked them. Pushing on up the bay, the tiny band of colonists eventually chose a location on the wooded and malarial banks of the James River, named in honor of King James I. The site was easily defended, but it was mosquito-infested and devastatingly unhealthful. There, on May 24, 1607, about 100 English settlers, all of them men, disembarked. They called the place Jamestown. The early years of Jamestown proved a nightmare for all concerned, except the buzzards. 40 would-be colonists perished during the initial voyage in 1606 to 1607. Another expedition in 1609 lost its leaders and many of its precious supplies in a shipwreck off Bermuda. Once ashore in Virginia, the settlers died by the dozens from disease, malnutrition, and starvation. Ironically, the woods rustled with game and the rivers flopped with fish, but the greenhorn settlers, many of them self-styled gentlemen, unaccustomed to fending for themselves, wasted valuable time grubbing for non-existent gold when they should have been gathering provisions. Virginia was saved from utter collapse at the start largely by the leadership and resourcefulness of an intrepid young adventurer, Captain John Smith. Taking over in 1608, he whipped the gold-hungry colonists into line with the rule, "He who shall not work, shall not eat." He had been kidnapped in December 1607 and subjected to a mock execution by the Indian chieftain Powhatan, whose daughter Pocahontas had saved Smith by dramatically interposing her head between his and the war clubs of his captors. The symbolism of this ritual was apparently intended to impress Smith with Powhatan's power and with the Indians' desire for peaceful relations with the Virginians. Pocahontas became an intermediary between the Indians and the settlers, helping to preserve a shaky peace and to provide needed foodstuffs. Still, the colonists died in droves, and living skeletons were driven to desperate acts. They were reduced to eating dogs, cats, rats, and mice, and even to digging up corpses for food. One hungry man killed, salted, and ate his wife, for which misbehavior he was executed. Of the 400 settlers who managed to make it to Virginia by 1609, only 60 survived the starving time winter of 1609 to 1610. Diseased and despairing, the remaining colonists dragged themselves aboard homeward-bound ships in the spring of 1610, only to be met at the mouth of the James River by a long-awaited relief party headed by a new governor, Lord de la Warr. He ordered the settlers back to Jamestown, imposed a harsh military regime on the colony, and soon undertook aggressive military action against the Indians. Disease continued to reap a gruesome harvest among the Virginians. By 1625, Virginia contained only some 1,200 hard-bitten survivors of the nearly 8,000 adventurers who had tried to start life anew in the ill-fated colony. When the English landed in 1607, the chieftain Powhatan dominated the native peoples living in the James River area. He had asserted supremacy over a few dozen small tribes, loosely affiliated in what somewhat grandly came to be called Powhatan's Confederacy. The English colonists dubbed all the local Indians, somewhat inaccurately, the Powhatans. Powhatan, at first, may have considered the English potential allies in his struggle to extend his power still further over his Indian rivals, and he tried to be conciliatory. But relations between the Indians and the English remained tense, especially as the starving colonists took to raiding Indian food supplies. The atmosphere grew even more strained after Lord De La Warr arrived in 1610. He carried orders from the Virginia Company that amounted to a declaration of war against the Indians in the Jamestown region. A veteran of the vicious campaigns against the Irish, De La Warr now introduced Irish tactics against the Indians. His troops raided Indian villages, burned houses, confiscated provisions, and torched cornfields. A peace settlement ended the First Anglo-Powhatan War in 1614, sealed by the marriage of Pocahontas to the colonist John Rolfe, the first known interracial union in Virginia. A fragile respite followed, which endured 8 years. But the Indians, pressed by the land-hungry whites and ravaged by European diseases, struck back in 1622. A series of Indian attacks left 347 settlers dead, including John Rolfe. In response, the Virginia Company issued new orders calling for a perpetual war without peace or truce, one that would prevent the Indians from being any longer a people. Periodic punitive raids systematically reduced the native population and drove the survivors ever farther westward. In the Second Anglo-Powhatan War in 1644, the Indians made one last effort to dislodge the Virginians. They were again defeated. The Peace Treaty of 1646 repudiated any thought of assimilating the native peoples into Virginia society or of peacefully coexisting with them. Instead, it effectively banished the Chesapeake Indians from their ancestral lands and formally separated Indian from white areas of settlement, the origins of the later reservation system. By 1669, an official census revealed that only about 2,000 Indians remained in Virginia, perhaps 10% of the population the original English settlers had encountered in 1607. By 1685, the English considered the Powhatan peoples extinct. It had been the Powhatans' calamitous misfortune to fall victim to three Ds, disease, disorganization, and dispossibility. Like native peoples throughout the New World, they were extremely susceptible to European-born maladies. Epidemics of smallpox and measles raced mercilessly through their villages. The Powhatans also, despite the apparent cohesiveness of Powhatan's Confederacy, lacked the unity with which to make effective opposition to the comparatively well-organized and militarily disciplined whites. Finally, unlike the Indians whom the Spaniards had encountered to the south, who could be put to work in the mines and had gold and silver to trade, the Powhatans served no economic function for the Virginia colonists. They provided no reliable labor source, and, after the Virginians began growing their own food crops, had no valuable commodities to offer in commerce. The natives, as far as the Virginians were concerned, could be disposed of without harm to the colonial economy. Indeed, the Indian presence frustrated the colonists' desire for a local commodity the Europeans desperately wanted, land. The fate of the Powhatans foreshadowed the destinies of indigenous peoples throughout the continent as the process of European settlement went forward. Native Americans, of course, had a history well before Columbus's arrival. They were no strangers to change, adaptation, and even catastrophe, as the rise and decline of civilizations such as the Mississippians and the Anasazis demonstrated. But the shock of large-scale European colonization disrupted Native American life on a vast scale, inducing unprecedented demographic and cultural transformations. Some changes were fairly benign. Horses, stolen, strayed, or purchased from Spanish invaders, catalyzed a substantial Indian migration onto the Great Plains in the 18th century. Peoples such as the Lakotas, or Sioux, who had previously been sedentary forest dwellers, now moved onto the wide open plains. There they thrived impressively, adopting an entirely new way of life as mounted, nomadic hunters. but the effects of contact with Europeans proved less salutary for most other native peoples. Disease was by far the biggest disruptor, as old-world pathogens licked lethally through biologically defenseless Indian populations. Disease took more than human life. It extinguished entire cultures and occasionally helped shape new ones. Epidemics often robbed native peoples of their elders, who preserved the oral traditions that held clans together. Devastated Indian bands then faced the daunting task of literally reinventing themselves without benefit of accumulated wisdom or kin networks. The decimation and forced migration of native peoples sometimes scrambled them together in wholly new ways. The Catawba Nation of the southern Piedmont region, for example, was formed from splintered remnants of several different groups, uprooted by the shock of the Europeans' arrival. Trade also transformed Indian life, as traditional barter and exchange networks gave way to the temptations of European commerce. Firearms, for example, conferred enormous advantages on those who could purchase them from Europeans. The desire for firearms thus intensified competition among the tribes for access to prime hunting grounds that could supply the skins and pelts that the European arms traders wanted. The result was an escalating cycle of Indian-on-Indian violence, fueled by the lure and demands of European trade goods. Native Americans were swept up in the expanding Atlantic economy, but they usually struggled in vain to control their own place in it. One desperate band of Virginia Indians, resentful at the prices offered by British traders for their deerskins, loaded a fleet of canoes with hides and tried to paddle to England to sell their goods directly. Not far from the Virginia shore, a storm swamped their frail craft. Their cargo lost, the few survivors were picked up by an English ship and sold into slavery in the West Indies. Indians along the Atlantic seaboard felt the most ferocious effects of European contact. Farther inland, native peoples had the advantages of time, space, and numbers as they sought to adapt to the European incursion. The Algonquins in the Great Lakes area, for instance, became a substantial regional power. They bolstered their population by absorbing various surrounding bands and dealt from a position of strength with the few Europeans who managed to penetrate the interior. As a result, a British or French trader wanting to do business with the inland tribes had little choice but to conform to Indian ways, often taking an Indian wife. Thus was created a middle ground, a zone where both Europeans and Native Americans were compelled to accommodate to one another, at least until the Europeans began to arrive in large numbers. John Rolfe, the husband of Pocahontas, became father of the tobacco industry and an economic savior of the Virginia colony. By 1612, he had perfected methods of raising and curing the pungent weed, eliminating much of the bitter tang. Soon, the European demand for tobacco was nearly insatiable. A tobacco rush swept over Virginia as crops were planted in the streets of Jamestown and even between the numerous graves. So exclusively did the colonists concentrate on planting the yellow leaf that at first they had to import some of their foodstuffs. Colonists, who had once hungered for food, now hungered for land, ever more land on which to plant ever more tobacco. Relentlessly, they pressed the frontier of settlement up the river valleys to the west, abrasively edging against the Indians. Virginia's prosperity was finally built on tobacco smoke. This bewitching weed played a vital role in putting the colony on firm economic foundations. But tobacco, King Nicotine, was something of a tyrant. It was ruinous to the soil when greedily planted in successive years, and it enchained the fortunes of Virginia to the fluctuating price of a single crop. Fatefully, tobacco also promoted the broad-acred plantation system, and with it a brisk demand for fresh labor. In 1619, the year before the Plymouth Pilgrims landed in New England, what was described as a Dutch warship appeared off Jamestown and sold some 20 Africans. The scanty record does not reveal whether they were purchased as lifelong slaves or as servants committed to limited years of servitude. However it transpired, this simple commercial transaction planted the seeds of the North American slave system. Yet blacks were too costly for most of the hard-pinched white colonists to acquire, and for decades few were brought to Virginia. In 1650, Virginia counted but 300 blacks, although by the end of the century, blacks, most of them enslaved, made up approximately 14% of the colony's population. Representative self-government was also born in primitive Virginia, in the same cradle with slavery, and in the same year, 1619. The Virginia Company authorized the settlers to summon an assembly, known as the House of Burgesses. A momentous precedent was thus feebly established, for this assemblage was the first of many miniature parliaments to flourish in the soil of America. As time passed, James I grew increasingly hostile to Virginia. He detested tobacco, and he distrusted the representative House of Burgesses, which he branded a seminary of sedition. In 1624, he revoked the charter of the bankrupt and beleaguered Virginia Company, thus making Virginia a royal colony directly under his control. Maryland, the second plantation colony, but the fourth English colony to be planted, was founded in 1634 by Lord Baltimore of a prominent English Catholic family. He embarked upon the venture partly to reap financial profits and partly to create a refuge for his fellow Catholics. Protestant England was still persecuting Roman Catholics. Among numerous discriminations, a couple seeking wedlock could not be legally married by a Catholic priest. Absentee proprietor Lord Baltimore hoped that the 200 settlers who founded Maryland at St. Mary's on Chesapeake Bay would be the vanguard of a vast new feudal domain. Huge estates were to be awarded to his largely Catholic relatives, and gracious manor houses, modeled on those of England's aristocracy, were intended to rise amidst the fertile forests. As in Virginia, colonists proved willing to come only if offered the opportunity to acquire land of their own. Soon they were dispersed around the Chesapeake region on modest farms, and the haughty land barons, mostly Catholic, were surrounded by resentful backcountry planters, mostly Protestant. Resentment flared into open rebellion near the end of the century, and the Baltimore family for a time lost its proprietary rights. Despite these tensions, Maryland prospered. Like Virginia, it blossomed forth in acres of tobacco. Also like Virginia, it depended for labor in its early years mainly on white indentured servants, penniless persons who bound themselves to work for a number of years to pay their passage. In both colonies, it was only in the later years of the 17th century that black slaves began to be imported in large numbers. Lord Baltimore, a canny soul, permitted unusual freedom of worship at the outset. He hoped that he would thus purchase toleration for his own fellow worshippers. But the heavy tide of Protestants threatened to submerge the Catholics and place severe restrictions on them, as in England. Faced with disaster, the Catholics of Maryland threw their support behind the famed Act of Toleration, which was passed in 1649 by the local representative assembly. Maryland's new religious statute guaranteed toleration for all Christians, but, less liberally, it decreed the death penalty for those, like Jews and atheists, who denied the divinity of Jesus. The law thus sanctioned less toleration than had previously existed in the settlement, but it did extend a temporary cloak of protection to the uneasy Catholic minority. One result was that when the colonial era ended, Maryland probably sheltered more Roman Catholics than any other English-speaking colony in the New World. While the English were planting the first frail colonial shoots in the Chesapeake, they also were busily colonizing the islands of the West Indies. Spain, weakened by military overextension and distracted by its rebellious Dutch provinces, relaxed its grip on much of the Caribbean in the early 1600s. By the mid-17th century, England had secured its claim to several West Indian islands, including the large prize of Jamaica in 1655. Sugar formed the foundation of the West Indian economy. What tobacco was to the Chesapeake, sugarcane was to the Caribbean, with one crucial difference. Tobacco was a poor man's crop. It could be planted easily. It produced commercially marketable leaves within a year, and it required only simple processing. Sugarcane, in contrast, was a rich man's crop. It had to be planted extensively to yield commercially viable quantities of sugar. Extensive planting, in turn, required extensive and arduous land clearing, and the cane stalks yielded their sugar only after an elaborate process of refining in a sugar mill. The need for land, and for the labor to clear it and to run the mills, made sugar cultivation a capital-intensive business. Only wealthy growers, with abundant capital to invest, could succeed in sugar. The sugar lords extended their dominion over the West Indies in the 17th century. To work their sprawling plantations, they imported enormous numbers of enslaved Africans, more than 250,000 in the 5 decades after 1640. By about 1700, enslaved blacks outnumbered white settlers in the English West Indies by nearly 4 to 1, and the region's population has remained predominantly black ever since. West Indians thus take their place among the numerous children of the African diaspora, the vast scattering of African peoples throughout the New World in the 3.5 centuries following Columbus's discovery. To control this large and potentially restive slave population, English authorities devised formal codes that define the slaves' legal status and their masters' prerogatives. The notorious Barbados Slave Code of 1661 denied even the most fundamental rights to slaves and gave masters virtually complete control over their laborers, including the right to inflict vicious punishments for even slight infractions. The profitable sugar plantation system soon crowded out almost all other forms of Caribbean agriculture. The West Indies increasingly depended on the North American mainland for foodstuffs and other basic supplies. And smaller English farmers, squeezed out by the greedy sugar barons, began to migrate to the newly founded southern mainland colonies. A group of displaced English settlers from Barbados arrived in Carolina in 1670. They brought with them a few enslaved Africans, as well as the model of the Barbados Slave Code, which eventually inspired statutes governing slavery throughout the mainland colonies. Carolina officially adopted a version of the Barbados Slave Code in 1696. Just as the West Indies had been a testing ground for the encomienda system that the Spanish had brought to Mexico and South America, so the Caribbean islands now served as a staging area for the slave system that would take root elsewhere in English North America. Civil war convulsed England in the 1640s. King Charles I had dismissed Parliament in 1629, and when he eventually recalled it in 1640, the members were mutinous. Finding their great champion in the Puritan soldier Oliver Cromwell, they ultimately beheaded Charles in 1649, and Cromwell ruled England for nearly a decade. Finally, Charles II, son of the decapitated king, was restored to the throne in 1660. Colonization had been interrupted during this period of bloody unrest. Now, in the so-called Restoration Period, empire building resumed with even greater intensity and royal involvement. Carolina, named for Charles II, was formally created in 1670, after the king granted to 8 of his court favorites, the Lords Proprietors, an expanse of wilderness ribboning across the continent to the Pacific. These aristocratic founders hoped to grow foodstuffs to provision the sugar plantations in Barbados and to export non-English products like wine, silk, and olive oil. Carolina prospered by developing close economic ties with the flourishing sugar islands of the English West Indies. In a broad sense, the mainland colony was but the most northerly of those outposts. Many original Carolina settlers, in fact, had emigrated from Barbados, bringing that island's slave system with them. They also established a vigorous slave trade in Carolina itself. Enlisting the aid of the coastal Savannah Indians, they forayed into the interior in search of captives. The Lords Proprietors in London protested against Indian slave trading in their colony, but to no avail. Manacled Indians soon were among the young colony's major exports. As many as 10,000 Indians were dispatched to lifelong labor in the West Indian cane fields and sugar mills. Others were sent to New England. One Rhode Island town in 1730 counted more than 200 enslaved Carolina Indians in its midst. In 1707, the Savannah Indians decided to end their alliance with the Carolinians and to migrate to the backcountry of Maryland and Pennsylvania, where a new colony founded by Quakers under William Penn promised better relations between whites and Indians. But the Carolinians determined to thin the Savannahs before they could depart. A series of bloody raids all but annihilated the Indian tribes of coastal Carolina by 1710. After much experimentation, rice emerged as the principal export crop in Carolina. Rice was then an exotic food in England. No rice seeds were sent out from London in the first supply ships to Carolina, but rice was grown in Africa, and the Carolinians were soon paying premium prices for West African slaves experienced in rice cultivation. The Africans' agricultural skill and their relative immunity to malaria, thanks to a genetic trait that also, unfortunately, made them and their descendants susceptible to sickle cell anemia, made them ideal laborers in the hot and swampy rice plantations. By 1710, they constituted a majority of Carolinians. Moss festooned Charlestown, also named for the king, rapidly became the busiest seaport in the South. Many high-spirited sons of English landed families, deprived of an inheritance, came to the Charleston area and gave it a rich, aristocratic flavor. The village became a colorfully diverse community, to which French Protestant refugees, Jews, and others were attracted by religious toleration. Nearby, in Florida, the Catholic Spaniards abhorred the intrusion of these Protestant heretics. Carolina's frontier was often aflame. Spanish-incited Indians brandished their tomahawks, and armor-clad warriors of Spain frequently unsheathed their swords during the successive Anglo-Spanish wars. But by 1700, Carolina was too strong to be wiped out. The wild northern expanse of the huge Carolina Grant bordered on Virginia. From the older colony, there drifted down a ragtag group of poverty-stricken outcasts and religious dissenters. Many of them had been repelled by the rarefied atmosphere of Virginia, dominated as it was by a big plantation gentry belonging to the Church of England. North Carolinians, as a result, have been called the quintessence of Virginia's discontent. The newcomers, who frequently were squatters without legal right to the soil, raised their tobacco and other crops on small farms with little need for slaves. Distinctive traits developed rapidly in North Carolina. The poor but sturdy inhabitants, regarded as riffraff by their snobbish neighbors, earned a reputation for being irreligious and hospitable to pirates. Isolated from neighbors by raw wilderness and stormy Cape Hatteras, graveyard of the Atlantic, the North Carolinians developed a strong spirit of resistance to authority. Their location between aristocratic Virginia and aristocratic South Carolina caused the area to be dubbed a veil of humility between two mountains of conceit. Following much friction with governors, North Carolina was officially separated from South Carolina in 1712, and subsequently each segment became a royal colony. North Carolina shares with tiny Rhode Island several distinctions. These two outposts were the most democratic, the most independent-minded, and the least aristocratic of the original 13 English colonies. Although Northern Carolina, unlike the colony's southern reaches, did not at first import large numbers of African slaves, both regions shared in the ongoing tragedy of bloody relations between Indians and Europeans. Tuscarora Indians fell upon the fledgling settlement at New Bern in 1711. The North Carolinians, aided by their heavily armed brothers from the south, retaliated by crushing the Indians in the Tuscarora War, selling hundreds of them into slavery and leaving the survivors to wander northward to seek the protection of the Iroquois. The Tuscaroras eventually became the sixth nation of the Iroquois Confederacy. In another ferocious encounter 4 years later, the South Carolinians defeated and dispersed the Yamasee Indians. With the conquest of the Yamasees, virtually all the coastal Indian tribes in the southern colonies had been utterly devastated by about 1720. Yet in the interior, in the hills and valleys of the Appalachian Mountains, the powerful Cherokees, Creeks, and Iroquois remained. Stronger and more numerous than their coastal cousins, they managed for half a century more to contain British settlement to the coastal plain east of the mountains. Pine-forested Georgia, with the harbor of Savannah, nourishing its chief settlement, was formally founded in 1733. It proved to be the last of the 13 colonies to be planted. 126 years after the first, Virginia, and 52 years after the 12th, Pennsylvania. Chronologically, Georgia belongs elsewhere, but geographically it may be grouped with its southern neighbors. The English crown intended Georgia to serve chiefly as a buffer. It would protect the more valuable Carolinas against vengeful Spaniards from Florida and against the hostile French from Louisiana. Georgia indeed suffered much buffeting, especially when wars broke out between Spain and England in the European arena. As a vital link in imperial defense, the exposed colony received monetary subsidies from the British government at the outset, the only one of the original 13 to enjoy this benefit in its founding stage. Named in honor of King George II of England, Georgia was launched by a high-minded group of philanthropists. In addition to protecting their neighboring northern colonies and producing silk and wine, they were determined to carve out a haven for wretched souls imprisoned for debt. They were also determined, at least at first, to keep slavery out of Georgia. The ablest of the founders was the dynamic soldier-statesman James Oglethorpe, who became keenly interested in prison reform after one of his friends died in a debtor's jail. As a competent military leader, Oglethorpe repelled Spanish attacks. As an imperialist and a philanthropist, he saved the Charity colony by his energetic leadership and by heavily mortgaging his own personal fortune. The hamlet of Savannah, like Charleston, was a melting pot community. German Lutherans and kilted Scots Highlanders, among others, added color to the pattern. All Christian worshippers except Catholics enjoyed religious toleration. Many missionaries armed with Bibles and hope arrived in Savannah to work among debtors and Indians. Prominent among them was young John Wesley, who later returned to England and founded the Methodist Church. Georgia grew with painful slowness, and at the end of the colonial era was perhaps the least populous of the colonies. The development of a plantation economy was thwarted by an unhealthy climate, by early restrictions on black slavery, and by demoralizing Spanish attacks. Certain distinctive features were shared by England's southern mainland colonies, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. Broad-acred, these outposts of empire were all in some degree devoted to exporting commercial agricultural products. Profitable staple crops were the rule, notably tobacco and rice, though to a lesser extent in small farm North Carolina. Slavery was found in all the plantation colonies, though only after 1750 in reform-minded Georgia. Immense acreage in the hands of a favored few fostered a strong aristocratic atmosphere, except in North Carolina and to some extent in debtor-tinged Georgia. The wide scattering of plantations and farms, often along stately rivers, retarded the growth of cities and made the establishment of churches and schools both difficult and expensive. In 1671, the governor of Virginia actually thanked God that no free schools or printing presses existed in his colony. All the plantation colonies permitted some religious toleration. The tax-supported Church of England became the dominant faith, though it was weakest of all in nonconformist North Carolina. These colonies were in some degree expansionary. Soil butchery by excessive tobacco growing drove settlers westward, and the long, lazy rivers invited penetration of the continent and continuing confrontation with Native Americans.